Okay, so yeah, as you might have heard on this talk, I'm going to be discussing a little bit about some ideas of inexpensive time travel devices and how the future might not exist. And just to open that up, not going to go over this idea of like time is this line and we can hop back and like meet our parents, the whole Back to the Future thing. But what I am interested in is alternative conceptions of time itself, different sort of ontologies, temporal ontologies, different ways of being in time, and a few sort of artistic touchstones that really spoke to me about that. And to kick it off with, this is a really inspirational project that kind of set me thinking. This is the Chimurenga Chronicle, and this was a newspaper that was published in 2011 across Africa, headquartered in South Africa in Cape Town. But the whole conceit of this newspaper, they were like, we're going to take this newspaper, make a 300-page print object, but writing as if it were this one week in May 2008. And that was their framing of it. They're like, let's think about cheap ways to travel in time and cheap ways to rethink. The editor-in-chief, this guy, Anton Njabi, he's a Cameroonian, a writer, and a DJ. And I'm just going to read a bit from an interview he gave around the time of this newspaper, Chimurenga Chronicle, that really stuck with me. So he says, whether time is perceived as linear or secular, depending on whatever philosophy one adheres to, my own sense is that we seem to be caught in these perspectives that we don't engage with them enough. We wanted to play with the idea of time traveling, and we wanted to use the tool that is specifically invented to mark time and space, the newspaper, to then use that tool to deconstruct both the tool and our sense of time. And then he goes on, although we created a newspaper which is set in 2008 and will be released in October 2011, we decided that we were not going to do a retrospective. We are saying instead, it is 2008, and we are physically in 2008, and today we are producing the news of 2008 to engage with the colonial project of the newspaper. Our sense of history and our sense of what is important and our sense of record are all marked by that medium. It's a fascinating project. And so that then, I'm sort of going to give a framework. I'm going to be talking about Aztec-inspired ideas of cyclical time and a lot of young, new Mexican music, and as well as a project of my own called Sufi Plugins, and then a little bit about a specific type of Mexican music here in New York City and its ideas about newness and how it relates to those sort of narratives. And here's another sort of touchstone of my thinking. This is a book called Atomic Aztecs. It was published by Seshu Foster back in 2005. And the cover is terrible, but the book is interesting. So in the book, it's weird fiction, and it tells the story of a guy who's simultaneously in two different time worlds. In one of these worlds, what we consider here and now, works at a slaughterhouse in East LA. You know, so this terrible job, like cutting pigs for meat. But then he'll have like a sudden headache, and then he'll emerge into this other equally real time world where he's kind of like a Aztec warrior. You know, he's like a security, he works in a security detail for a contemporary society in which the Aztecs won. And so what happened there was that when the Europeans arrived, they didn't win. Instead, the sort of Aztec ideas, ways of being, they won. And there's a really nice quote from the beginning of Atomic Aztecs, which sort of sets the tone. I mean, he's saying, to think that they want to foist that vision of reality on the rest of us, meaning the Europeans arriving, Columbus and crew, that's the insult. Barbaric, cheap aesthetic based on flimsy, mechanistic notion of the omniverse as a Swiss watch, set to ticking by some sort of trinity. Luckily, we Aztecs believe in circular concepts of time, cyclical conceptions of the universe. And one of the things that makes this novel great, I mean, is that these two time worlds are never really resolved. It's just kind of always held in tension and bristling back and forth against the other. Different ideas of how we clock time in conflict. And one of the things that makes it funny is that the spelling, he uses alternative spelling when he's in the Aztec time with lots of K's and X's and everything. And then sort of rewinding back further on the literary landscape, here's a guy, great American hero, Oscar Zeta Acosta. And if Seshu Foster is talking, thinking about indigenous time versus sort of a capitalistic time in the space of literature, Oscar Zeta Acosta is unique in that he brought he entered in through literature. You know, he was friends with Hunter S. Thompson and did all the sort of gonzo journalism style autobiography mixed with fiction, but he was actually a practicing lawyer. I believe he's the first Chicano lawyer to be licensed by the California Bar. And so he brought this idea of different temporalities into law itself. There's a great book. He wrote two books and then disappeared, probably on a drug run in Mexico, kind of a crazy life. But this second book is called The Revolt of the Cockroach People. And in it, he chronicles his experiences defending Chicano militants in LA in the late 60s. And so it starts off by referencing this guy here on the left, which is Huitzilopochtli, Aztec god of sun and war and human sacrifice. And we'll come back to him in a bit. But so the book begins, and I love this beginning because he's putting the sort of calendar, cyclical calendar time overlapped with this ideas of Aztec time. So the start is, it is Christmas Eve in the year of Huitzilopochtli, 1969. 300 brown-eyed children of the sun have come to drive the money changers out of the richest temple in Los Angeles. From the mansions of Beverly Hills, the faithful have come in black shawls, the dead fur of beasts out of foreign jungles. Calling us savages, they have already gone into the church, pearls in hands, diamonds in their Colgate teeth, while out in the night, 300 greasers from across the town sing tribal songs in an ancient language. And again, this is sort of a lyrical autobiography, but he's talking about very real things. So for example, in 1979, Oscar Zeta Acosta ran for sheriff. And on his business cards throughout the books and in the campaign posters, there's this constant, the image of Huitzilopochtli appears like this. This is Oscar Zeta Acosta for sheriff. And he's constantly talking about sort of invoking these pre-Columbus ideas of like Aztlan, the land mass that was sort of, seceded to the states. And this sort of idea of a very, very contemporary, but very kind of radical conception of rootedness in place. And so one last quote to read is that him, basically he ran, one of the things he did, in addition to defending militants and these radicals and organizing at a wide scale for Chicano rights, he ran for sheriff one year, and he actually came for sheriff of LA County, and he came in second place with 119,000 votes. And what he was saying was just amazing, because he was taking this idea, he was entering into the discourse of law with a very specific intention of abolishing it. You know, he's like, I like to break the laws. You know, it's like, in many ways in my life, I like to break these laws, but I think that they're unjust and they should be destroyed. And so this is his, he says, I have but one issue. I know there's no hope for actual victory at the ballot box. If I were elected sheriff, I would make every attempt to dissolve the office. The community has no need for professional killers. The law enforcement officers of this country and of this nation in general are here for the protection of the few and the maintenance of the status quo. The police are the violent arm of the rich, and I would get rid of them. You know, so that's what he's about. And then reading a lot of these Chicano and Mexican writers, thinking about time, thinking about in the sort of indigenous overland to the present, that leads me directly into this, which is these two guys are among the young kids who founded a style of music called tribal prehispanico, you know, pre-Hispanic tribal music. And starting in around 2005, this is like the new sounds bubbling out of, it began in Mexico City and then quickly spread to Monterrey, where they're from. It's Eric Rincón, his sister, and then a guy called Sheiko Beat. And these kids were listening a lot to, they're listening a lot to Israeli psytrance, which is very big in Mexico. They're listening a lot to all sorts of North regional Mexican music, which is big. They were doing their YouTube readings. There was a Mexican artist named Jorge Reyes. So Jorge Reyes, sort of older electronic guy, he was making very new age music in the 80s and 90s, but using pre-Columbian instruments, you know, flutes, drums, and he would do things like go to sacred pyramid sites and perform it, and it had this huge sort of impact, you know, especially on kids of this generation. And so in 2005, a guy called Ricardo Reyna in Mexico City, he was making a standard house track, but he added some some sort of indigenous flute and percussions, and he called it tribal prehispanico. And this sort of kickstarted this whole genre. And so it was a scene of kids using loop-based musical software, specifically a software called Fruity Loops, who were very consciously invoking ideas of, here's like an early CD cover, very consciously invoking ideas of the sort of Aztec and indigenous history, folded into the present, but in a non-ironic way. So this is the Andino pre-Hispanic method by, this is a guy called Javier Estrada. And Javier Estrada is of particular interest to me because, again, he's so consciously working with these ideas of what might pre-Hispanic time be. And his whole musical practice is based on constant output. You know, there's no ledger, until very recently, there's nothing available for sale, but he'd released over 700 tracks onto the internet for free just to be put into circulation. And he's working with all sorts of, contemporary electronic music forms, like the tribal prehispanico, which has become quite popular. Javier Estrada, in particular, would integrate elements of various types of EDM, like dubstep, Skrillex sounds, house, hip-hop, but always with this kind of, this really fascinating insistence on stuff like this. This says prehispanic Mumbaton gods. Back to prehispanic, Mumbaton, a very new genre. And then he's all wrapping it up. I'm just going to play you a little bit of a remix he did called No Hay Navidad. He's taking a very, a massive hit by Los Cadetes de Linares, big North Mexican band, and the song itself is called There's No Newness. It's a love song, and the guy's talking about how, his wife, his lover has left him, but there's nothing new here. I'll let this roll. From the 60s, 70s, and 80s and recontextualizing them. And one of the things that really struck me about this particular project of Javier Estrada's is I was thinking, oh yeah, with the standard sort of remix narrative in music is that you take the old music, the roots music, the indigenous music, you push it through the laptop and push it through the sampler and somehow make it new, make it available and understandable to a new generation of people. And I was asking him about it, and he's like, no, that wasn't the point. He's like, I made this music so that my dad would listen to the songs I make. Basically, his father hates this crazy electronic music he makes. His father also doesn't like this weird pre-Hispanic, the sort of indigenous flutes and drum sounds. But so what he did was he took these sort of weep, sad cowboy classics, and that was what he used. So it's one of the rare instances of someone taking on remix ideas, but using it as intergenerational discussion, using it to directly kind of pull in his older father and pull back. And back to Huitzilopochtli, I first started making these connections between what Seishu Foster is writing about, the Huitzilopochtli in the works and writing of Oscar Zeta Acosta, when I heard a Javier Estrada track that sampled, particularly people speaking in Nahuatl about Huitzilopochtli. And I was like, wait, where have I heard that before? And that's kind of what sent me down this whole wormhole. And again, it's a very interesting moment of a very mutation-based youth culture, very internet savvy, very digitally fluid, but they're getting this grounding and using a lot of ideas of what it makes to cut and paste in a digital world, but very informed by these long-term ways of being and existing. And so I'm gonna switch gears for a moment. I'm actually gonna come back to Mexican music in a bit. But here's a project I'd like to discuss quickly, a project of mine called Sufi Plugins. which is sort of something conceptually compatible with a lot of the things that kids are doing here. And what Sufi Plugins is basically it's a suite of apps, free apps for making music. And they work inside of a program. Right now, you're looking at a program called Ableton Live. And this is an example of one of the synthesizers I have called HeJazz. And as you can see, I can move my cursor around. Actually, there's not so much. All this, everything is clearly labeled. It just happens to be clearly labeled in the script, the Berber language of Tamazir. And the script is called Neo-Tifinagh. And one of the main goals, the main ideas behind this project is thinking about non-Western poetic lyrical ideas of sound and what they might be like encoded into the digital. And so in this, there are 7 plugins at the moment, 7 different little bits of music making tools that can fit inside of programs. And 4 of them are synthesizers. They're software synthesizers like this, but they're just hardwired to North African and Arabic scales. And so this is a HeJazz, and so it's set to this, the HeJazz is the maqam, the sort of scale it's set to. And this is what it sounds like with. It's a different one. And in addition to that, there's a clapping drum machine, which you also heard. And there's a drone generator that uses 4 different voices and can take incoming sounds and filter them into a sort of rich drone. Thinking of drones as music with its temporal edge removed. The drones are about sounds in space, sounds that linger, kind of sound as body. And there is also there's a plugin called Devotion. And so what Devotion does is 5 times a day during the Muslim call to prayer, it'll lower the overall volume of your computer. And the thing with Devotion is that there are presets, and the presets are fervent, agnostic, apostate, devout, and so on. And those determine how much or how little it's lowered by. And with that, atheism is not an option. And part of this whole project was thinking about how to embed or how to acknowledge different temporalities, different ways of reading different character sets into a very kind of into the digital. And one of the direct answers is, of course, you know, just the design and layout. But another aspect is that everything you can roll over, I would insert a bit of Sufi poetry. And so in this particular one, HeJazz, what I wanted here was basically it's the first 2 lines of it's 2 lines taken from Rumi. So Rumi is 13th century Persian poet, mystic philosopher, back when a time when those were all sort of variations of the same thing. But this is kind of a technique I borrowed from the poet Caroline Bergvall, who's got a piece which is just reading every line of the translations of Dante's Inferno. So this is each different line is each different knob will give you a translation of the Rumi text. And the reason I chose this specific Rumi text is because it's referencing a ney flute, and this is a flute which is often played in a specific maqam. So it's often played in which the scales for that this synthesizer is around, is built around. And the sound of the synth itself has that sort of reedy, bristly flute sound. But yeah, so here you go. It's poetry in unusual places. Listen to the story told by the reed of being separated. Listen to this reed as it is grieving. It tells the story of our separations. Listen to this neigh while it is complaining. The story of separation from God it's explaining. And so basically, we're getting, you know, like, 9 centuries of different translations of Rumi into English. And so they vary wildly, and some God is there and some God is not. Listen to this neigh, the reed flute, that is complaining and narrating the story of separation. And of course, this is a play on like the untranslatability of poetry. And just thinking of, again, sort of a temporal superimposition. But let's forge ahead. I think I'm gonna give you a lot of information and then we can open up the floor and start talking. Here's just another example of a different one in action. How many more times this year? And this was inspired as well by thinking about how I worked in this project in part in Morocco, a place which I've had a long musical engagement with. And it was inspired in part by people like this man, Adil El Mouloudi. And I'm going to play a little bit of his music here. Let's see, here we go. Cheb Adil. And I found this music so compelling. For about the past 10 years, I've been hearing songs like this, in which everything is acoustic, acoustic utar, that you can see, acoustic bendir. Everything is acoustic except for the voice, which is dredged in autotune. And so I was thinking of this, it's so fascinating, a sort of Berber, Maghrebi musical form, and which very aware of contemporary trends, you know, what's going on overseas with Cher and whatnot, but the only aspect of sort of Western or electronic production is autotune on the voice itself. It's not a 4-4 beat, you know, it's not a drum machine or a cheesy synth sound, it's only this sort of vocal modulation. Skip ahead. And throughout, I was also, as I spent time in Morocco and just spent time listening to Moroccan music, I began realizing that it was often in the female vocals that on which autotune was the most sort of pronounced and surprising. So this is a woman called Hafida, wedding music. Time, I would get these sort of very old musics and very traditional, even conservative musics with sort of strange updates of the electronic, strange updates in contemporary conversations. And particularly, a quick aside, is that I began wondering as to why this was, you know, why autotune spread so quickly, why this, and so at a very basic level, the vocal fluctuations, a lot of like the melisma and ululation, that's precisely where autotune doesn't work. You know, autotune is very, it's the way it works is by it's looking at the grid you can see up top, and then the further you vary from the grid, the more it affects your voice. And so, of course, I mean, there are many parts of the world where quarter tones, vocals that slide through pitches, that's a very, people are trained to listen to that. That's where a lot of the pleasure of a vocal performance, someone who can control that sort of slide through sound. And so in a sense, one of the reasons why it hits so hard in Morocco is that, bam, you know, like people are already focused there and that's where things really fluoresce. And then I also started wondering about, well, why is it that the female vocals, like why is it in this whole tradition of wedding music? And this is another interesting sort of eruption of cyclical time. I mean, it's a long backstory, but this is a good friend's sister, Berber woman in South Morocco. And the idea is that one of the sort of long-standing notions of what it means to be a good Berber woman is expressed in song through like the clear clarion voice, like the sort of, almost like the blues figure, the woman who can cry, she lives in the mountains, she's unsullied by the city, she speaks proper Berber without any traces of Arabic, and this is all corresponding to very traditionalist, very sort of like imagine if time were frozen, ideas of Berber identity, which of course, you know, in an age of urbanization, internet, Facebook, it's slipping very rapidly, but then you get this thing, what happens is with, you know, when the autotune enters, it's actually, in a way, it's amplifying and making audible fairly conservative ideas of womanhood. And I think that's why this sort of something which, in the States, it's often derided as a quick, like, cheap novelty, like T-Pain, whatever. Whereas there, it's functioning in a radically different way, linked to much longer and older ideas of identity. And now I'm going to return to, you know, Mexico is a very exciting and powerful place to me, and there's a lot going on. So I'm going to end this last 10 minutes or so talking about type of music called cumbia, cumbia sonidera, which, as you can see, Maryland, New Jersey, Mexico. It's a transnational musical form, and specifically here in New York City, a lot of the cumbia sonidera takes the form of it's people playing cumbias, and let me see, I can just play a bit. Here's an example.
Y esto es para que lo bailes y lo toques. Lo toques y lo bailes. Con el sonido Guinner. Es aniversario.
And at these parties, it's the DJ as animator. The DJ is the guy who's sort of shepherding the crew through. And particularly with this music, it's not a music... Here we go, I can show you a nice photo. This is a party. So every weekend in New York City, there'll be parties in Edinburgh, New York City. This is taken under the BQE in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. And so here's another example of a kind of typical, almost, you know, sort of ridiculous fantasy sci-fi approach to these covers. Here's another one, pretty standard. But yeah, so the way it works is that people playing electronically produced cumbias, people making cumbias with, you know, Fruity Loops and various programs like that, and there's someone talking over the music nonstop the entire time, giving shout-outs to people. And people send in shout-outs via text message, via note, and how that works is that it'll be shout-outs to someone in the room, but it'll also be like, hey, give it, you know, shout-out to such and such a sister away in Georgia, or shout-outs to my parents down back home in Puebla. And out of this whole scene of cumbia music, it's specifically people don't buy the CDs where it's just the songs. People only, the main selling musical item is these CDs with CDs and videos of these events where everything is very, very personalized. And in a way, I'm fascinated by this cumbia sonidera scene, but I started thinking about it, you know, and in many ways, it's very conservative, you know. As a musical genre, it's not interested in newness. You know, the musical productions, the CDs, they're not paying it. It's not like the Mexican music being made back in Mexico earlier, Javier Estrada and such, where people are very engaged with new sounds and with being in dialogue with other genres. Cumbia is kind of content to be what it is. And one of the ways I discovered that was the case was just by the difficulty in IDing what year a song was made. Could be 2002, could be 2012. Also on the songs with lyrics, the lyrics tend to be very, very light, very fluffy in a sense. Often songs about cumbia or about dancing cumbia. And this is in sharp, marked contrast to the other types of Mexican music which are so popular here, specifically like norteño and duranguense, very much song ballad forms where it's like, this is the narrative of such and such person crossing the border, doing whatever it is. So you have this, on the one hand, this body of music which is all about storytelling, and then cumbia, which is all about the other thing. And so to me, this particular scene asks, it's like, why does music have to change? And the answer is it doesn't. You know, it's music that is, instead of being tapped into ideas of progress, it's very much about presence. It's about people gathering in a room. It's about sending messages back and forth. It's about a kind of, I like to call it like a de-virtualization of social meaning. It's like, we could send, you know, you could send a message to your sister via Facebook and she would get it, but instead you pay $40 to gather into some weird, difficult to get to spot, make sure you pass a note to this guy, and then he reads it out, and then you buy the recording of him reading it out, and you send it, you know, via the mail. So it's very digital, so very up-to-date in many ways, but then also about, like, let's control every aspect about how this one brief little message, and the message is that of, hey, I see you, hey, you're there, hey, I remember you. And again, this is up against the sort of greater musical sphere, which is all about novelty, all about newness, you know, like, it affects everyone. It's deep in DJ culture, of course. It's deep in radio, music journalism, this idea of musical trends. Like, that's, even in the avant-garde, quite literally, this notion of, like, we need to be musically progressive and to be constantly changing. Cumbia downshifts in a way, which is very radical. So you have a music, which is, you know, it's from working class, often undocumented people living here in New York City, and it just rejects categorically the ideas of authorship, capital A authorship, rejects ideas about growth in music, and it's sort of happy to just be. And one of the, I think just to end, I'm going to talk with one of the fascinating trends that I've recognized in New York City, Cumbia Sonidera, and that is songs about the Taliban. Pro-Taliban, not pro-Taliban songs, but I'll play one and then I'll talk about it. Here we go. So actually the first one, this the one I was playing in. This song. So that's called Taliban in Victoria, but it's in the instrumental beat with the Sonidero style shout out. So he's just, that's just the sort of background context. But this one is actually called She is the Taliban Princess. Aya.
Talibana, baila cumbia como colombiana. Le dice a todos mis amigos. Le dice a todos mis amigos. Ella es la princesa talibana.
See, he's saying she's the Taliban princess. She dances cumbias like she is a Colombian, which is also a synonym for a Mexican fan of cumbia. And that's it. Then he's like, she says to all my friends, come dance with me. And then it repeats. And in a way, this is a very typical kind of cumbia lyrical treatment. Like nothing, there's no story being told as we're used to thinking of it. And so I started wondering about these because there's lots of them. You know, there'd be songs about Bin Laden, and it's always in this sort of weird, lighthearted mode. And then I realized, you know, it's like there's something actually very powerful about a sort of non-hysterical and yet unironic reaction to these ideas of terror narratives and thinking about what it means to be in New York City in a post 9/11 time. You know, specifically this idea of war on terror. You know, suddenly it's like there's a cause, there must be some sort of effect. All sorts of very heavy real world things are happening as a result of this largely specious narrative of some sort of like troubling progress that must be halted, this, that, and the other thing. So in contrast to that, cumbia sonidera as a genre, it interrupts that. They're like, you know, like all these terror, these ridiculous terror narratives, which so much hinges upon, like, we're gonna make it mundane to pull it back into just these like daily cycles of songs. The Taliban becomes a song about dancing. So going from the sort of what I consider like a completely fake and constructed narrative of terrorism, heroicism, and very back into notions of she's a Taliban princess, we're gonna dance. It's a lighthearted, very orthogonal approach to that. But ends up being, yeah, quite powerful and resonant in the end. And so I think that draws the one-way talk section to a close. All these different musical and literature ideas have kind of spoken to me in the terms of a very, very profound rejection of the standards, like I said, the narratives of growth and newness, and narratives of linearity in time, with some really fascinating repercussions. And a lot of it comes from DJ culture, where this idea of loop and remix, but yet it goes deeper with this grounding, with the Mexican stuff, with the grounding with ideas, often sort of Xeroxed and passed on, ideas about what indigenous culture means, what time could be like, how we could be dealing our time differently. So, thank you.
Plenty of time for questions. If you want to ask a question, please come up and speak into the mic just so we can get a recording. And kind of maybe just a quick question to start. How much similarity is there between kind of cumbias about the Taliban and narcocorridos and like the unending war on drugs? Is that similar at all, or is that
you see, the
not
thing,
not
the interesting. Structurally, they're really radical. They're completely different because specifically, like, one of the reasons why the narco corridos are so popular is because, like, capos will pay someone to be like, right, like, we just killed some guy, like, we just killed the enemy, this, you know, feuding boss, write a corrido about it to celebrate it, you know? like one of the Los Tigres del Norte, one of their most famous corridos about pulling, you know, taking weed across the border, was turned into a movie. It's this idea of very like a Hollywoodization about it. There's actually one of like those very creepy new developments in the sort of narco corridos called Movimiento Alterado, where instead of sort of like talking about the drug dealer, it's literally people narrating as if they were killers, you know, as if they were sicarios. And so listening to it, I'm like, oh, that's the verb for disembowel. Now I know. You know, it's like very detailed stories of this. Whereas, you'd think like, oh, Taliban's being referenced, like in hip hop or like UK grime music, sometimes people reference Taliban to mean like the heaviest of the heavies, you know, like Taliban Trim is a UK grime artist from London and all this. But it's not. It's not never used in any sort of context of war, which is what really called the attention to me. Yep. And it's funny to think about nonlinear time and sort of indigenous times in this very strange room, the sort of like, this, yeah. I should talk into the mic.
Oh, sorry. Do you think there's any parallels between, say, like the role of cumbia music and like? I remember reading like stuff like disco or sort of like top 40 now, where it's like music that's just self-referential. It's like it's a song about being in the club dancing to that music, or it's disco about, hey, I'm gonna go dance in this style of music. Is that just a theme that comes up cyclically in music itself, or do you think there's any relationship between these things? Or?
Oh, I mean, I guess it is a theme that comes up in certain types of music, like certain types of dancing-oriented music, like cumbia. Well, like, let's talk about how great the song is. Yeah, I think with this stuff, because there's this layer of like these like direct address on top of it, and because the way in which it's sort of performed and activated in the city is, it's not just about the kind of like club hedonism, which is the interesting thing to me. You know, like embedded in these songs are these ideas like messages. I see you in the room. I see her in the room, which is very different from like we're gonna party all night long. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, thank you. That's super interesting.
And if you don't want to come walk down all the way, you can stand up and shout, and I can repeat it into the microphone. This is for the invisible people who live in the clouds.
I guess when you like hearing you talk about cumbias and the way that like the DJ is kind of emceeing and talking over the song and shouting out people, you know, I guess I'm now thinking about how like that's kind of referential to early hip hop parties. But immediately I drew parallels to dance hall sound system culture, even in them, and go-go in DC, and how, I mean, those very same things, like even in DC, if like you got your name shouted, you couldn't wait to go and try to find that tape on Monday and Tuesday because they gave you a shout out on that tape or gave your sister a shout out on that tape, so you could present it to. So it was like all these different steps removed. Like, wow. Right, like you could send a Facebook message, but instead I went to the go-go, may have risked my safety myself, and then had to go and buy a tape afterwards to show you that, hey, I did this for you. I'm wondering how does it can is go-go tapes, briefly CDs, and Jamaica was tapes. How is this music? How is it archived? Like the parties and the music.
Oh, interesting. That's funny. I guess how's it archived? Unfortunately, it's actually really poorly archived. Like, no, I think, and that's a side effect of this sort of like laissez-faire approach to time and history. It's like, it's cumbia in particular, it's not really reverential towards its past. It's like reggae, it's like version culture is big. Like, this is a song which many groups have done. But it's unlike reggae insofar as, like, name your top 12 singers. It's less about that. It's more like, oh, this version's cool. This is familiar. So it actually is, it's like of great sadness to me, you know, because that's the difference between analog and digital. You know, with vinyl records, I can go back and be like, okay, this is such and such bands, such and such cumbia band from, you know, early 80s. These are the players, this is what, and like a chronology is quite fixed. But a lot of it, you can see, like these CDs, it's, a lot of it is very, oftentimes they won't even put the date on it, no contact information, cell phone number that's gone, and there's no sense of it being, it's a very ephemeral culture. But I am very glad you brought up go-go, because like, I'm actually sort of attracted to these musics, like go-go and like cumbia, which never quite made it into like a wider national conversation, and I'm like, so it's not exactly music of failure, but music which, maybe it's hyper-local, maybe it has these all these codes like I was saying with cumbia. It's like not about trying to be cool or trying to be new. It's more about, it's more in a sustain mode versus like a sort of like a get out there and shout mode. And it's fascinating with the go-go shout-outs. Like I had no idea about that. So I think you get these systems where like a cultural form, which is less interested in both preserving itself, but then also sort of justifying itself in other arenas, or like less aspirational cultural forms are often harder to just even spot and follow in many ways.
What would you call like a, so like, would it be like your sound system, that you would what is a cumbia?
Oh yeah, so it's called the sonido, like the sound. It's, so yeah, and it'll be like, often it's, actually it's very much in that, it has nothing to do with Jamaica insofar as it's like very, like there's no crossover, but it's like the person who has the sound will often be the person on the mic, or maybe it's someone else selecting, and they'll often be the people who are like hiring out the hall and renting this, you know, getting like their own sound system in there. Like those, this photo, just randomly, is, it's an athletic hall, like under the BQE, but what they do is like there are cumbia parties and then there's like Caribbean parties, you know, like West Indian parties that happen there. And each person will bring in their rig and their lighting and their this and their that and do it. Yeah.
They got a speaker back, guys.
What's that?
They got a speaker back.
Oh yes, yeah, and that's like a Mexico's, you see that a lot in like Mexico City in the subway, people like walk on hyper portable playing music that they'll then sell you on CD and speaker backpacks. Yeah. So.
I'm not really big on, you know, listening to music at home, but if I wanted to go somewhere in New York to hear cumbia sonadera, where would I go, or how would I find information on where it's being played in public?
You would go to, I guess, wherever, probably like wherever you can find, it's a Mexican phenomenon. So in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, there's a large Mexican community, and that means like just posters on the walls and this and that, and you can sort of, you can kind of tell because their style, like the posters pretty much look like the CD covers. But there are parties everywhere, that's the thing. There are parties in everywhere, meaning, you know, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, New Jersey, Maryland, all around. But it's always, I mean, it's social, if you're not, it can be a strange event, you know, because it'll be like, it's this whole thing about everywhere else in this entire city, DJs are about kind of like keeping the night moving. Cumbia parties, like they'll play cumbia, then they'll stop. And then they'll play like bad rock song or like weird techno, and so the dance floor clears. Because again, it's kind of like it's about couples dancing, and so there's this whole thing of like a cumbia, which might be beautiful, some strange dance floor clearing song on purpose, and then back to the cumbia. So it's a fascinating and disruptive. When I think of like Jamaican sound systems, they're disruptive in a very different way. But again, it's. And yeah, and a lot of the people, you know, it's also a lot of them will perform at things like quinceañeras, like the 15-year-old birthday parties and house parties and whatnot. But Estrellas de la Cumbia, they're a big group from New York City. And then there's just like, yeah. And there's certainly stores around that will sell this stuff, and they'll always know because they're happening all the time. That's the thing. It's one of these hidden in plain sight phenomenons. Yeah. Okay.
Is there a relation between Colombian cumbia and Mexican cumbia?
Okay, the question is there a relation between Colombian cumbia and Mexican cumbia? It's, yes, it's kind of one way. It's, you know, cumbia sort of started in Colombia, but then nowadays it's like largely considered like Christmas time music. Like nobody cares about cumbia, everyone's vallenato and salsa, whatever. So there it's kind of on the down, but in Mexico there's this whole thing of like when Colombian cumbia artists, like their careers start to like peak and then go down in Colombia, they tend to move to Mexico, like historically for the past 20 or 30 years. And so you'll have, particularly in like North Mexico and Monterrey, there's this whole kids who call themselves Colombianos, they call themselves Colombians, and they listen to cumbia. So it'll be like, you know, like they listen to like reggaeton and cumbia, but they're, and they dress in, it's like a whole weird youth subculture, but the Colombia is like the mythical reference for where this music came from. And even it's so cumbias colombianas, in a Mexican context, it just refers to a style of cumbia that's popular in Mexico. At this point, it's like completely, not severed, but distant from Colombia. Yeah, it's fascinating, actually. It's a really strange migration. You had? Bands with okay. Huh. Interesting. Funny. I have yet to see a laptop used in like a cumbia context. Oh, just in general. Okay. So yeah, and that's just part of like the, it's less expensive to bring out a laptop and like run the keyboard off it or run a beat off it than to hire a keyboardist. Yeah, yeah, that's definitely a very, very present phenomenon.
Is there anything like that in Morocco?
Oh, Morocco. It's funny, it can be very hard to see music in Morocco outside of a kind of like a private family gathering type context. But the little music there is, it's usually, again, it's non-laptops. It's still laptop. It's not like a luxury item, but usually musicians, it's still difficult to get and difficult to use, you know? So they'll be, like the default there will be, you know, like the violinist who plays at a bar all night long, like the sort of, he'll have just like a, it's kind of incredible actually, have, I think you have a specific bar, specific guy in Casablanca, but he'd have like 6 or 7 effects pedals, so guitar effects pedals, and then he'd had it figured out, so he's making his violin sound incredible, like at certain times it'd sound like a guitar, other times like an accordion, like really complicated like signal processing things sorted out, as a direct result of like he's the guy who has to play requests from, you know, for all this time. Yeah, but like nobody auto-tunes live. Like that's a real rarity. I was talking to a lot of people about it, and I'd be like, you know what, you can do it with the laptop. I'd be like, no. Well, I heard there's a guy in that one city who does it, and once I heard someone played a festival with it. But yeah, it's a strange marker between specifically auto-tune is a strange marker between like studio recordings and live performances. And it's actually an issue. Like some people are bad singers live. They like pop up. They become popular for their auto-tunes. But somehow they don't manage to sing with autotune live, and so they have these very short-lived careers. It's strange.
Because of that resistance.
Because they don't autotune live, then people go see them wanting the shimmery, shiny voice, and they're like, ugh, that's painful.
Question about Sufi plugins.
Yes.
You said that you were using the Berber written language and the symbology, but I noticed you also had that Thomas Pynchon symbol.
Oh.
why did you decide to use that?
The unstoppered horn. You know, it's there. There are many layers in these plugins. Many, many layers. Yeah, and it's never. So that playfulness is important to my conception of it, and not all the rollover pop-ups are all Sufi texts. Like, there's some texts from other ways that sneak their way in. So yeah. Yeah, thinking of multiple visual languages, I think that's it. And wanting this kind of element of surprise and defamiliarity to be present throughout. Like, at a very basic level, I'm like, oh, I want an interface that will sort of, I can show you a different photo. I want an interface that will be, here's, so the top one's a different synthesizer and the bottom one's a drum machine. So non-straightforward, but something that will kind of draw you in at least and to encourage people to start listening with their ears and twisting the knobs and kind of a more exploratory approach to sound. And then the pinch and horn works as kind of like an in-joke, you know, like a handful of people have written me about it. And I was like, yes, that's there on purpose. Right by waist, right? Yeah, and then the actual, like, all this logos layout was done by a guy named Rostin Wu, who's fantastic.
Sure. Yeah, I just had a question about it applies to the cumbia, but also came to my mind when you're talking about Trey Ball. Uh-huh. Do the kids that are making it use samples? And if not, how do they get that swing out of Fruity Loops?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's another impressive part. I didn't really go into that, but like, there's this whole thing of a lot of the Trey Ball music, they're working with like triplets and three time, which like does not play well with the default settings of this software, Fruity Loops, they have. And thinking of like that tension between what music kids move to and then like what software allows you is partly what made me enter into these, kind of from working with Moroccan musicians. But in the Tribal, it's a mix. Yeah, there's like weird grid stuff that they figured out. A lot of it's a mix of sample based, and even people like Javier Estrada, he's like, yes, you know, he gathers sound banks like indigenous flutes, but then he'll also like sort of collect those instruments and just do like basic playing to then create a sample and fitting it into it. But it's kind of an impressive use. Like earlier we were talking about how like digital English is this kind of this spreading international language. And it's really present, especially in the software, because I've seen kids, you know, in Mexico, in Egypt, who are like using that software, everything's written in English, and sort of working their way out, trying to force it into beat patterns, which, you know, they're, you know, the swing or whatever, the feeling they were trying to get, and then go to like YouTube tutorial and just look for like, so, and end up looking, kind of trying to like decipher basic English language YouTube electronic music tutorials. Like there's a ton of them, they're all in English. And so people, then it becomes super graphic. It's many layers of like interpretation and struggle go on to get these very basic things. But then the flip side of that, like one of those guys at Tribal, like I was there in 2008, and they've since like formed this sort of group, and it's really exploded. They've become a pop phenomenon, like on TV all the time. You can get their CDs in any sort of place that sells Mexican music here. Like, really kind of like culturally significant stuff. And when I was talking to them and their producer, Toy Selecta, way back then, Toy was convinced. He's like, this is gonna go huge, because when people listen to it, like when Mexicans anywhere in the world hear this, they're gonna hear those roots. They're gonna hear that's referencing stuff like banda, stuff like norteño, stuff with this triplet feel built in. And history proved him right. Like the fact that they had to work so hard to get that timing in there was proof that it was very core to what they were trying to transmit, and then the popularity of the sound that resulted, I think speaks for itself. Yeah, I think that's...
Maybe just like one last question? So you're talking about cumbia sonidera as kind of a sustainable music.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sustainability a good thing? And if so, should we be learning from it? I'm just to kind of look at it in a broader sense.
Yeah.
I mean, no, because it's interesting. It's like we've had a lot of people here who've talked about sustainability in mm-hmm. some sense, and I'm kind of interested if that plays into that, or if it's just conservative and something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question, because not straight... It's good insofar as it presents a challenge to these other like paradigms for like fast forward into the future, consume it, listen to the album in a day, write your review the next day, and like, who's Kanye West? I've forgotten, that was 2 weeks ago. You know, like cumbia's the opposite. But that said, like I would love to, I would love for it to be more sonically adventurous than it is. And it's a strange thing. Like, you have, it's kind of a bubble in many ways. And this lack of interest in engaging an outside world is purposeful, and it's a protective bubble, and it's about this sort of like safe space of community. But what that means is that, it's a strange line. So neither.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Come back for more.